For a week this spring, NPR's Steve Henn allowed a small team of computer experts to plant a bug in his home office and monitor his internet traffic. It was an eye-opening experiment, which he described earlier to David Green.
Yeah, the idea was for Steve to act as a stand-in for all of us and see just how much the NSA or anyone else who intercepted his internet connections could actually find out just by watching unencrypted traffic from his phone and laptop flow by. And Steve's team learned a lot, despite the fact that every major internet provider has added some kind of encryption to its services over the past year. Steve's life online was really easy to track. The team also realized that you don't have to be the target of the NSA or a hacker for your traffic to be intercepted in this way. There is this hole in mobile security that could make tens of millions of Americans vulnerable. It's been well known in the industry for years, and it could let even unsophisticated hackers capture your traffic, monitor your connections, even maybe steal your identity. Here again is Steve.
When I tapped my own internet traffic, Sean Gallagher, a reporter from the tech news site Ars Technica, came to my house and we took this little device. It's called a pwn plug, and it was invented by Dave Porcello, a computer security expert, and we took this thing and we physically attached it to my computer network. And now I'm going to turn on the Wi-Fi. Dave was on a speakerphone watching my internet traffic from his office in Vermont. Seeing how much data streamed out of my phone the second I connected kind of blew everyone away. My phone pinged Apple, Google, Yahoo, and then apps like Twitter and Facebook connected to the net. This all happened in just seconds, and I didn't touch the phone. If Dave was a hacker, those few seconds could have been a goldmine.
And anything that you're logged into, basically when you can reconnect, it basically re-logs in. So there's an opportunity for an attacker to capture either the cookie or maybe even just password.
And it turns out the device in your pocket, your beloved smartphone, chances are really good that it is constantly out there, relentlessly looking for networks like this to connect to.
Pretty much. Basically, yeah.
Oliver Weiss works with Dave Porcello at their company, Pony Express.
So when you have wireless turned on, your phone or your laptop is sending out what are called probe requests out to the world saying, hey, where's my network? Hey, where's my network? Is this network around? Where's this network?
There's this book I read to my kids by P.D. Eastman. It's called Are You My Mother? And it's about this tiny baby bird that falls out of its nest and goes wandering around the world, asking whatever it meets, are you my mother? First, it asks a cow, and then a dog. And then it asks a cat. Weiss says there are actually evil Wi-Fi networks out there in the world that are programmed to act like a hungry cat, that when approached by your little baby telephone, will say, yes, I am your mother. Yes, I'm your network. And if your phone believes that cat...
At that point, it's in the middle and it can basically intercept all traffic going through it.
The cat has captured all of your traffic. That open Wi-Fi connection opens doors for hackers. They can get in the middle of transactions between, say, you and your bank. And Oliver Weiss used this kind of man-in-the-middle attack to capture an email password.
So, I don't know if you can read that.
Password equals ponies one, or ponies exclamation point. So it just captured your username and password.
Exactly.
Now, if you set up your phone correctly and only sign on to Wi-Fi networks you know, you could make these attacks more difficult. But some of America's biggest companies, like AT&T and Comcast, are aggressively rolling out nationwide, open, public Wi-Fi networks. Networks that are insecure.
Imagine taking your home internet with you when you leave the house.
Now, these guys aren't the only companies doing this, but they're the biggest. Comcast is turning customers' cable boxes into public Wi-Fi hotspots and has a million hotspots across the country. AT&T offers open Wi-Fi connections at most Starbucks.
A big problem with AT&T phones is that they all have a preferred network on their list. By default, that's open, and that's AT&T Wi-Fi.
And Oliver Weiss says there's no password.
So when, you know, your AT&T phone is near an open AT&T Wi-Fi network, it'll automatically connect.
It will connect to a legit AT&T Wi-Fi hotspot, or hotspots called AT&T Wi-Fi that are set up by hackers or us. And Auk says if folks are just walking by one of these evil hotspots and their phone connects, they will probably never know.
There's all this stuff going on behind the scenes. I mean, literally invisible packets in the air coming out of their pocket saying things about who they are and where they've been and what they do.
In the past year, the number of people using Xfinity Wi-Fi has almost tripled. Comcast told me that the number of out-of-home Wi-Fi sessions shot up 750%. Don Bailey, a security expert at LabMouse, says these public Wi-Fi connections don't have to be insecure.
There should be a way to identify whether or not you've attached to a public Wi-Fi.
He says that should happen automatically. He says when you connect to a Wi-Fi network like this, all your traffic should be encrypted without you having to do anything. And in fact, both Comcast and AT&T already offer consumers apps that will do this. But you have to buy them, install them, and opt in. So most people don't. I asked both companies if these open Wi-Fi networks were opening up millions of their consumers to potential attacks. AT&T said it took extraordinary measures to keep its consumers safe. Comcast said it was planning to roll out a more secure Wi-Fi network sometime in the future, but it didn't say when.
That reporting coming from Steve Henn, and Steve joins us on the line right now to talk about the series. And Steve, one interesting lesson from this experiment, I mean, we are all really vulnerable in those moments when our mobile device or computer is trying to connect to a public Wi-Fi network. If Comcast can make networks like this more secure, I mean, what's the holdup?
Well, part of the problem is that for Comcast to roll out a more secure system, it needs the cooperation of everyone who uses it. So Apple, Android, device manufacturers, they all have to agree to use the same system. So that takes time. And it's one of the issues we've seen again and again throughout the series. The other problem that we've noticed is that even when companies roll out encryption, there are often bugs. So we found a bug in Google's location data that they've now patched. We found that Snapchat was showing when kids signed up for their service in the clear, and they fixed that as well. And we've seen lots of examples. And unless you really dig through the packets and the traffic, you don't see when encryption is breaking down.
And that's probably difficult for people like me who don't do this kind of stuff to dig through things like that and find out when things are breaking down. Anything that I can do, given all the leaks that you found, to make myself more secure?
Well, there are lots of little things you can do, like you can mess with your settings on your phone, turn off Wi-Fi or turn off location services. But I think for most people, that really doesn't work. For encryption to keep us all safe, I think it has to be built into the background and so simple to use that it's happening without us even knowing it. I mean, the one positive thing that's come out of this reporting for me is that we're seeing companies begin to move to that. And that was just unheard of a year ago.
Interesting week of reporting. NPR technology correspondent Steve Henn. Steve, thanks a lot.
My pleasure.
Facebook plans to start selling more of its users' data to advertisers. The announcement today is part of Facebook's effort to ramp up online ad revenue through better targeted ads. Facebook also plans to let users see why they're hit with certain ads. NPR's Arthi Shahani reports.
Facebook is a business, and Facebook users are not the customer. We, me too, are the product that Facebook is selling to advertisers. Online ad money has been so good, Facebook has beat Wall Street's earnings expectations for the last year. And the changes the company is making over the next few weeks should make it more profitable.
What's different and what's new is that now Facebook is bringing in information from outside of Facebook.
Deborah Aho Williamson is an analyst with eMarketer. Facebook already tracks the websites you visit and the other mobile apps you download. Before, the company says it just used that information to improve user experience and online security. Now, Facebook will sell that data to advertisers.
If you were a soccer fan who also visited golfing websites but didn't tell Facebook that you were interested in golfing, Facebook might now know that information and be able to deliver targeted ads to you for golfing.
Facebook is also rolling out a tool to let users see why a specific ad was targeted to them and to block a specific advertiser. Say you didn't want the golf ad. Aho Williamson explains you can use the tool to tell Facebook.
And then it'll say, well, what are you interested in? And then you have an opportunity to, if you want to, share with them what you are interested in.
These changes do mean more tracking, and the burden is on users to block ads. But privacy advocate Todd Ruback with Ghostery is happy with Facebook in one key respect. It is making choices clear for users.
Really, the issue with consumers is about tell me about it first. Let me know so I can decide whether or not it's appropriate for me.
Back in 2011, Facebook broke promises about privacy to users and had to settle charges with the Federal Trade Commission. Arthi Shahani, NPR News in San Francisco.
The big video game extravaganza in Los Angeles, known as the Electronic Entertainment Expo, or E3, ended yesterday. Some 45,000 people descended on the city to get a sneak peek at new game titles, though many of them were sequels, like Far Cry 4 and Halo 5. But as NPR's Laura Seidel reports, along with those old titles came an old issue, the lack of diversity of video game characters.
There's a myth. Only nerdy white guys play and make video games. At its E3 press conference, Microsoft didn't do much to change that image. There was only one female who stood on stage and spoke. Bonnie Ross heads the Microsoft studio that produces its blockbuster game Halo. She spoke for less than 2 minutes.
When we think about the Halo universe, we think of it as a real place inhabited by real characters.
Lee Alexander, who writes about the culture and business of games for the website Gamma Sutra, is a diehard gamer, but says Microsoft has turned her off of its Xbox console.
That branding has never really appealed to me. And when I watched the Microsoft press conference, just it felt very more of the same to me. I didn't experience any diversity.
It's a complaint that's been dogging the game industry since its earliest days.
I think it's a fair comment.
Microsoft Vice President for Devices and Studios, Youssef Mehdi.
We are very conscious about, do we have women who are up on stage for us, telling the story, playing some of the games? I think we had some up there yesterday telling our story, but we can do more, we want to do more.
But what was on stage reflected what was in the games. One game among this year's titles sparked a firestorm on the internet. The latest Assassin's Creed Unity takes place on the eve of the French Revolution. The game will be available for Microsoft's Xbox, but it's made by Ubisoft. There are four playable characters. Not one of them is female. In an interview with the gaming site Polygon, Unity's creative director, Alex Amancio, said having a female assassin was, quote, a lot of extra production work. Twitter lit up with the hashtag, women are too hard to animate. Game critic Alexander thinks Amancio's comments are revealing.
What their response reveals is that they didn't scope for it, that from the beginning it wasn't a concern.
Alexander was also among many, including game designers, who questioned why animating a woman was so hard.
I think they must presume that they're going to have to animate all these flowing dresses and flowing hair and jiggling breasts and things like that, which really interesting insight into how technical folks in the game industry view women's bodies.
In previous versions of Assassin's Creed, Ubisoft did have female protagonists. In a statement, Ubisoft says it's committed to diversity and it will continue to look at showcasing strong female characters. To the company's credit, actress, comedian, and gamer Aisha Tyler has hosted its E3 press conference for the last 3 years.
I am super excited to be here, and I hope you are too.
Tyler says initially she got a lot of flack from some gamers who refused to believe that she really plays.
To come and tell me that something that I've lived with and loved since I was a little kid is illegitimate, that I'm lying about it, I'll literally tell somebody to their face, you, and I've done it on this floor.
Tyler says she loves first-person shooter games like Halo and Gears of War, but she thinks there is a large segment of gamers that fit the white guy, loner, nerdy stereotype.
This is a group who has been excluded, and now they're turning and they're excluding. And the irony and the hypocrisy of that is extraordinary. So I do a lot of calling people on that. So no one let you into your club, and now you have one. You don't want to let anybody else in, and you know that you're just being full of it right now.
Tyler says over time, the criticism of her has decreased. Though early gamers may have been white guys, today nearly half are female. And according to the Kaiser Family Foundation, African Americans between the ages of 8 and 18 spend more time playing video games than white youth. Unfortunately, 85% of the people making the games are white and male.
So look at me, African American male, running the U.S. arm of a Japanese company.
Reggie Fils-Aimé is the president of Nintendo of America. He says Nintendo cares about diversity, but it has a bigger priority.
We view this as a way for people to have fun, and the way the characters are or the way we approach the business really is from that perspective.
Nintendo's new lineup, notably, does feature the princess from its blockbuster game Zelda as a warrior. And with its first Wii console, which emphasized fitness games, Nintendo grew its market among women. In 2013, the global industry for games passed $90 billion in revenue. The fastest growth was in mobile and online games, which are more diverse. Critic Lee Alexander says now that console games are being played online, the big game companies better expand their list of characters.
online competitive games were a big thing on show at E3, and no one is really going to want to buy those and play them only with 17-year-old boys.
And certainly the controversy over Assassin's Creed Unity showed that, on the internet, gamers are willing to fight not only to win, but to be heard. Laura Seidel, NPR News.
The big video game extravaganza in Los Angeles, known as the Electronic Entertainment Expo, or E3, ended yesterday. Some 45,000 people descended on the city to get a sneak peek at new game titles, though many of them were sequels, like Far Cry 4 and Halo 5. But as NPR's Laura Seidel reports, along with those old titles came an old issue, the lack of diversity of video game characters.
There's a myth. Only nerdy white guys play and make video games. At its E3 press conference, Microsoft didn't do much to change that image. There was only one female who stood on stage and spoke. Bonnie Ross heads the Microsoft studio that produces its blockbuster game Halo. She spoke for less than 2 minutes.
When we think about the Halo universe, we think of it as a real place inhabited by real characters.
Lee Alexander, who writes about the culture and business of games for the website Gamasutra, is a diehard gamer, but says Microsoft has turned her off of its Xbox console.
That branding has never really appealed to me, and when I watched the Microsoft press conference, just it felt very more of the same to me. I didn't experience any diversity.
It's a complaint that's been dogging the game industry since its earliest days.
I think it's a fair comment.
Microsoft Vice President for Devices and Studios, Youssef Mehdi.
We are very conscious about, do we have women who are up on stage for us telling the story, playing some of the games? I think we had some up there yesterday telling our story, but we can do more. We want to do more.
But what was on stage reflected what was in the games. One game among this year's titles sparked a firestorm on the internet. The latest Assassin's Creed Unity takes place on the eve of the French Revolution. The game will be available for Microsoft's Xbox, but it's made by Ubisoft. There are four playable characters. Not one of them is female. In an interview with the gaming site Polygon, Unity's creative director, Alex Amancio, said having a female assassin was, quote, a lot of extra production work. Twitter lit up with the hashtag, women are too hard to animate. Game critic Alexander thinks Amancio's comments are revealing.
What their response reveals is that they didn't scope for it, that from the beginning it wasn't a concern.
Alexander was also among many, including game designers, who questioned why animating a woman was so hard.
I think they must presume that they're going to have to animate all these flowing dresses and flowing hair and jiggling breasts and things like that, which really interesting insight into how technical folks in the game industry view women's bodies.
In previous versions of Assassin's Creed, Ubisoft did have female protagonists. In a statement, Ubisoft says it's committed to diversity and it will continue to look at showcasing strong female characters. To the company's credit, actress, comedian, and gamer Aisha Tyler has hosted its E3 press conference for the last 3 years.
I am super excited to be here, and I hope you are too.
Tyler says initially she got a lot of flack from some gamers who refused to believe that she really plays.
To come and tell me that something that I've lived with and loved since I was a little kid is illegitimate, that I'm lying about it, I'll literally tell somebody to their face, you, and I've done it on this floor.
Tyler says she loves first-person shooter games like Halo and Gears of War, but she thinks there is a large segment of gamers that fit the white guy, loner, nerdy stereotype.
This is a group who has been excluded, and now they're turning and they're excluding. And the irony and the hypocrisy of that is extraordinary. So I do a lot of calling people on that. So no one let you into your club, and now you have one. You don't want to let anybody else in, and you know that you're just being full of it right now.
Tyler says over time, the criticism of her has decreased. Though early gamers may have been white guys, today nearly half are female. And according to the Kaiser Family Foundation, African Americans between the ages of 8 and 18 spend more time playing video games than white youth. Unfortunately, 85% of the people making the games are white and male.
So look at me, African American male, running the U.S. arm of a Japanese company.
Reggie Fils-Aimé is the president of Nintendo of America. He says Nintendo cares about diversity, but it has a bigger priority.
We view this as a way for people to have fun And the way the characters are or the way we approach the business really is from that perspective.
Nintendo's new lineup, notably, does feature the princess from its blockbuster game Zelda as a warrior. And with its first Wii console, which emphasized fitness games, Nintendo grew its market among women. In 2013, the global industry for games passed $90 billion in revenue. The fastest growth was in mobile and online games, which are more diverse. Critic Lee Alexander says now that console games are being played online, the big game companies better expand their list of characters.
Online competitive games were a big thing on show at E3, and no one is really going to want to buy those and play them only with 17-year-old boys.
And certainly the controversy over Assassin's Creed Unity showed that, on the internet, gamers are willing to fight not only to win, but to be heard. Laura Seidel, NPR News.
The code-breaking skills of mathematician Alan Turing helped the Allies win World War II. He also devised the Turing test, a measure of artificial intelligence. Last weekend, a computer program pretending to be a 13-year-old boy named Eugene Goostman was the first to pass the test, meaning the age of artificial intelligence has begun. Maybe. Gary Marcus is a professor of cognitive science at New York University. I asked him to explain how the test works.
It was devised in the teletype era, so those of you who don't remember what a teletype is can think of it as text messaging back and forth. So you text message to a computer or a person, you don't know which, and you try to decide. And that's basically what actually happened, is somebody managed to build a computer program that was good enough to fool a third of the judges.
Siri sort of does that, right? You ask your phone questions, and you can even throw in some abstract ones, and it'll come up with some creative responses on occasion.
Siri, like this program Eugene Goostman, interacts with you. You ask questions, and it gives answers. But most people aren't fooled into thinking that Siri is an actual person.
People who are into science fiction, I think especially, get really excited when we see this headline, "Computer Passes the Turing Test." But you think maybe not such a big deal.
Well, it's a small sign of progress, but it's not really progress towards the larger goal of having machines that really understand us. It turns out that you can do a lot of misdirection, answer sarcastically, and evade the fact that you are a computer. So all it really shows is you can fool humans for a short period of time, about 5 minutes, not all of the humans, but maybe more than you might have expected, by having these sort of personality twitches.
And well, let's give an example of that. You had an exchange with an earlier version of this program. Well, why don't we read that? I will read the part of Eugene Goostman.
I will play the role of myself as best I can. Do you read The New Yorker?
I read a lot of books. So many, I don't even remember which ones.
You remind me of Sarah Palin.
If I'm not mistaken, Sarah is a robot, just as many other quote-unquote people. We must destroy the plans of these talking trash cans.
Now, see, your first impression, if you had that line in isolation, would be, hey, that's clever. It sounds like a 13-year-old boy, which is what the program's supposed to sound like. But if you talked to it for a long time, you would see that it uses the same laugh lines over and over again. If you asked it questions about common sense, you would find out very quickly that it doesn't really understand the world, that it's just a lot of pre-programmed responses and pattern recognition and so forth without any real there.
You know, I have to say from all of the exchanges that I've read with people who are talking with this machine, none of them seem very convincing. 30% of people need to be fooled for it to be considered to pass?
Based on a very, I think, foolish reading of Alan Turing's original essay, people decided that in order to, quote, pass this test, close quote, you'd have to fool 30% of the judges. And this program fooled 33% of the judges on this particular occasion. Turing was saying, I'm guessing that this is how far along we will be by the year 2000. He wasn't saying, and when we get there, that means that machines are necessarily intelligent. He was kind of opening the question, but people have taken his offhand suggestion as if it was the definition of intelligence. And I think that part's silly. And we might actually want to think about updating the Turing test for a modern era.
Yeah, because it seems, again, looking at these exchanges, maybe just 33% of people are more gullible, I hate to say it.
Yeah, it is kind of a gullibility test. What I suggested instead is have a machine watch a YouTube video or a TV broadcast and see if you can ask questions about it. So in order for a machine to understand an ongoing television program, an episode of Breaking Bad, the program would have to build up ideas over time. Well, this character does this. This is their motivation. This is the conflict. If we could get machines towards that, I think that would be real progress in AI. The Turing test itself, not so much.
So if this test doesn't really serve the purpose of determining whether we've broken through a barrier in artificial intelligence, is there anything valuable that can come out of it?
it gets people thinking about what will it be like when we do have intelligent machines that we really can interact with at that level, that follow us around, sort of like in that movie Her. I don't think that's going to happen in the next 20 years. It might take 40 or 50, but we will reach a society where we have more and more of these things around.
Gary Marcus is a professor of cognitive science at New York University. He's the author of Guitar Zero, and his forthcoming book is called The Future of the Brain. Gary, thank you.
Thanks a lot.
Every now and then you'll hear a story about a kid who has a lemonade stand or a cupcake sale to raise money for a good cause. Beyond that heartwarming headline is a belief that you can do capitalism with a conscience. Well, this is an idea that has taken root in Silicon Valley in a big, big way. Carlos Watson is the co-founder of the online magazine Ozzy. He says that young entrepreneurs there are starting businesses for social change. So, Carlos, who are these idealists and what are the causes they want to support?
Arun, one of the most interesting things that's happening in Silicon Valley and startup world more generally is that you've got people helping start incredible companies. And the folks who are helping start these are not just MBAs from Harvard or not just former investment bankers, or they're not even kind of Mark Zuckerberg-like techie nerds. In many cases, they're folks who came from the nonprofit sector who are increasingly starting incredible companies like Warby Parker, the eyeglasses company, Upworthy, which is one of the hottest kind of digital content startups out there, or even companies that are in the education space, like the hottest new ed tech startup, which is called Clever.
And how is this different from, you know, companies have been giving to charities, especially big companies, for a long time. Some even maintain their own. How is this different?
A handful of these actually do that as well. Actually, what I find interesting here, Arun, is that you've got people who believe that their work, whether it was with the Red Cross, their work, whether it was with an NGO, that it can help them build a big, serious business that can raise not even millions of dollars, but in the case of some of these companies, Arun, they're raising north of $100 million. And again, they believe that their ability to organize, their ability to make big things happen, even with relatively small budgets, and their ability in many cases to sell and persuade, they say that all of that has in many ways made them even better equipped to join the new gold rush in startup 2014.
You know, I have to admit, my first take on things tends to be cynical. And my first thought about this was that, oh, this is kind of sad. The best way to get people to be socially responsible is to assign a profit motive to it. Am I being too cynical?
You may be. I mean, I think it's at least worthy of a truly open conversation. I think, for example, what you would hear the folks in education technology say is, we worked in the school system. We worked in difficult schools. We worked there year after year, and we saw very little change. And the chances that we would make sure that even the poorest schools had really good technology or be able to really analyze a student's grades and figure out what kind of curriculum would be better is enhanced when you have a really good technology system. And that, frankly, that wasn't happening inside of a nonprofit or inside of a school system and has happened a lot better, a lot faster inside of a company. So is it sad that in some ways it's hard to see a nonprofit push uphill? It is. But on the other hand, am I at least happy that in lots of different realms that people are bringing fresh perspectives and fresh skills? So far, I am.
There are companies like you mentioned, Warby Parker, that when you buy a set of eyeglasses, they give one away for free. There are other examples like that in terms of charity when you're buying things. Why not just cut out the middle and just do the charity directly? It feels like it might be making it more complicated than it needs to be.
I think people would tell you that their interest and their instincts are complicated. And I think they would tell you that while charity is part of what they're interested in, it's not the whole thing. And that a meaningful part of what they're interested in as well, in some cases, if you're really candid, is building their own wealth. So I think this is a way better model, even if for those who are traditionally nonprofit oriented, it feels incomplete.
Carlos Watson is the co-founder of the online magazine Ozzy. Carlos, thanks as always.
Arun, good to see you. See you next week.